From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet actor Tom Hulse. In Amadeus, he played Mozart, and in Parenthood, he was the black sheep of the family. Now he's starring in Murder in Mississippi, a made-for-TV movie based on the story of three murdered civil rights workers, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman. Also, journalist Tom Rose investigates what he describes as the world's greatest non-event, the three whales trapped in the Arctic ice in 1988. It became an international obsession. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by Christine Lavin and They Might Be Giants, performers known for their sense of humor. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new series Elvis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. South African President F.W. de Klerk today legalized the African National Congress and promised to free Nelson Mandela. Thousands of blacks thronged the streets of several cities to celebrate the announcements, but black activists in several countries said that despite the move to legalize the ANC and dozens of other anti-apartheid groups, the white-run government must now follow through. De Klerk did not act to dismantle the foundation of apartheid, which would give South Africa's 28 million blacks a direct voice in running the country. President Bush today welcomed de Klerk's announcement as quite positive and said he would talk with Congress about the possibility of lifting U.S. economic sanctions, but the president indicated any easing would depend on South Africa making good on its promise to free Mandela. Lebanon is witnessing its worst ever intra-Christian violence in the third day of fighting between army troops loyal to General Michel Aoun and Lebanese forces militia led by Shamir Jaja. Mike Theodulu has more on the story.
Last year, about 900 people died in 6 months of fighting between Christians and Syrian-backed Muslim forces. This week, after just 3 days of inter-Christian warfare, well over 100 people have been killed. It's an indication of the intensity of the fighting, which the head of the Christian church today called mass suicide. Civilians, as always, are taking the brunt of it. More than 500,000 of them are spending yet another night in their underground shelters, many without food, light, or heating. Dozens of terrified children have been trapped in their schools since Wednesday. Under cover of a massive artillery bombardment, Aoun's men have launched a major ground offensive against the militia's headquarters, but it doesn't seem to have broken the stalemate. The battleground is not a field in the middle of nowhere. It's a city center as densely populated as New York. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
Florida's largest savings and loan has been taken over by federal regulators and accused of operating in an unsafe, unsound manner. Rick Stone of member station WUSF reports.
Well before the Office of Thrift Supervision took over at 3 o'clock today, it was clear that SunTrust was headed for trouble. It was $245 million in debt, with 1989 fourth quarter losses of $43 million. Late last year, federal regulators ordered SunTrust to sell its $30 million art collection, its corporate jet and sailboat, and state officials began the effort to oust SunTrust Chairman David Paul, who kept the artworks in his home and collected a salary of nearly $5 million. Today, Paul and other executives were removed as the institution was placed in the control of the conservator. The Office of Thrift Supervision said SunTrust Bank, the nation's 23rd largest thrift, should be able to conduct business as usual. For National Public Radio, I'm Rick Stone in Tampa.
Stock prices were higher on Wall Street. The Dow rose 16 points. This is NPR News. The government agreed today that Manuel Noriega is a prisoner of war, but said that even under the Geneva Convention, the former Panamanian leader can be prosecuted on drug charges in a civilian court. Justice Department spokesman David Runkel said prisoner of war status means Noriega can direct any complaints about prison conditions to a U.S. military liaison officer already designated by the Defense Department, but he will not be moved to a military jail. Noriega's attorneys have asked that their client be taken to a third country under the Geneva Convention. Late last year, students and faculty at the University of Wisconsin voted to terminate the ROTC program on campus because the military discriminates against gays and lesbians. Today, the school's final decision-making body, the Board of Regents, voted on the issue. Sharon Seibart has more from Madison.
Department of Defense policy forbids the military to commission gay men and lesbian women The Board of Regents agreed that such discrimination is not in accordance with university policy or Wisconsin state law. But a majority of the regents voted to keep the program on campus and lobby Congress and the Defense Department to change the policy. They argued that this gives the college more power to influence change. ROTC critics, like student representative Rob McGinnis, say this should be an issue of basic civil rights.
If this was a black thing or a woman's thing, would the response be the same? And I just don't believe it would be. I think it comes down to the fact that this is sexual orientation, if they're dealing with gays, allows them to turn the other cheek.
Anti-ROTC students and faculty say they'll keep the pressure on. For National Public Radio, I'm Sharon Seibart in Madison.
President Bush today urged Congress to swiftly approve his plan to boost spending on research and development. Bush went on the road to push his plans for a $71 billion increase in federal science and technology funds for fiscal 1991. I'm Frank Stasio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tom Hulce, received an Academy Award nomination for his portrayal of Mozart in the film Amadeus. In last summer's movie Parenthood, he played Steve Martin's gambling, conniving brother, Larry. Hulce also co-starred in Dominic and Eugene, Slam Dance, Echo Park, and Animal House. Currently, he's on Broadway in the military courtroom drama A Few Good Men. On Monday, you can see Hulce in an NBC movie called Murder in Mississippi. It's based on the murders of civil rights workers Michael Schwerner, James Chaney, and Andrew Goodman. They were killed by racists in 1964's Freedom Summer, when college students from the North went to the South to help register black voters. Hulce plays Schwerner, one of the organizers of Freedom Summer. I asked Hulce if he has any childhood memories of the murders of Schwerner, Chaney, and Goodman.
I had no idea what was going on at the time. I grew up outside of Detroit, and I was certainly old enough to remember, but I was in a very white, upwardly mobile kind of community, and really didn't have any idea. I was amazed when I sat down maybe 5 years ago and watched the PBS series Eyes on the Prize, how what an extraordinary event I had been alive during in our own country. I was just astonished and appalled that 20 years ago people proudly stood up in front of television cameras and proclaimed that some people deserved rights that others didn't in our own country.
You play Schwerner as someone who had an almost naive sense of confidence about the ability to change people when he first comes to the South,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually loses his confidence, but not his commitment.
Mm-hmm.
What is that interpretation based on?
That's actually what was written in the screenplay. There's a lot of factual material in the story, and there's a lot of fiction. There's more of an overview of different points of view that people had that were working in this movement. And so there is much more of a conflict between Chaney and Schwerner than there probably was in actual fact. But the issues of the roles of white Northerners coming down and working in the movement, and the black people that were there that felt that it was their responsibility to do the fighting on their own. It was a way to address those issues by putting a little conflict between these two guys. Mickey Schwerner, from what I've been able to understand, he knew that he was marked. He knew that he was risking a lot, and believed so strongly that he wouldn't go home.
The murders of Schwerner, Chaney, and Goodman are the murders that the feds in the movie Mississippi Burning are investigating. What was your reaction to Mississippi Burning?
I thought it was an extraordinary piece of filmmaking. About two-thirds of the way through, I got very angry because I felt that it was exploiting the background it was using without illuminating it in any way. It, in the end, was to me a story about a two cops trying to learn how to work together and had very little to do with what was actually going on down there. The filmmaking images were extraordinarily powerful, I thought.
Murder in Mississippi is about the civil rights movement in the South. And, you know, there still is so much separation in American culture between black and white. And I think it holds true for, like, nearly every aspect of American culture, including the entertainment industry. And I'm thinking even in movies, you know, that this was the movie probably with the most integrated cast that you'd ever worked in?
Yeah. Definitely.
Was there, I'm just curious if there was any sense of white actors and black actors being alone or together during the breaks of the film. In other words, did you have any sense of separation during the breaks?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. There isn't a lot of hanging out time on that kind of schedule, mm-hmm. working 16-hour days. The obstacles are always huge. It's close to 100 degrees, 90% humidity. So there isn't a lot of hanging around to begin with. But everyone was there because they wanted to be a part of this story. And, I mean, it was interesting. In the writing, I know that the writer and the producers were very clear that they didn't want to tell a story about white New Yorkers coming down and telling the people in Mississippi what to do. And so they kind of knocked down the level of skill. And Mickey had said some really extraordinary things in real life, mm-hmm. and I had to fight to get a touch of that potential into the story. And I thought it was really interesting because, you know, there were times when Jennifer and I felt like we were on the short end of the story, and in that way. Tables were perhaps a little reversed. I was talking to Blair about there was a whole kind of he had a whole side story that's not in the final cut about his relationship with his girlfriend, and he was talking about how rare it is for there to be a romance between two black characters in a film or on television, and how rarely you see them kissing, and you know, it had never even occurred to me. I hadn't even noticed that was true. And as irony would have it, that storyline got cut because of the time constraints.
Mm-hmm. Tom Hulce is my guest, and he co-stars as Michael Schwerner in the NBC TV movie Murder in Mississippi, which will be broadcast Monday night. He's also currently starring in the Broadway play A Few Good Men, and he's co-starred in the films Parenthood, Dominique and Eugene, Slam Dance, and Amadeus. So you're in Broadway now in A Few Good Men. Mm-hmm. This is a military courtroom drama. How do you approach theater differently from film in terms of the size of your gestures, knowing that there aren't going to be close-ups on stage?
I don't do it different.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in front of a camera, you know that the frame around your performance changes size. So in that way, if you know that the camera is seeing you from the top of your head to your shoulders, you know that if you're telling the story with your feet, nobody's going to see it. But other than that, I don't really think there's a difference.
A lot of our listeners probably saw you recently in Parenthood. And you're really like the most unredeemed character in the movie. You're a gambler, a liar. You use your parents, take things from them, never give anything back.
Are you finished?
You no good you. You know, it's almost like you're in a different movie in a way, because everything has a happy resolution except for your character.
Well, I guess a little real life just has to sneak up into any story.
Playing Jason Robart's son in this, did you try to pick up any gestures from him so it would be believable that you were of the same family?
We had hung out for about 2.5 months just previous to the filming, because we had done another film together in North Carolina. And so we had a kind of shared history that that hooked us into each other. You know, people had kind of been amazed at our sense of connection. So the work was more inside than externally.
Mm-hmm. When you got the role of Mozart in the film Amadeus, mm-hmm. what kinds of discussions did you have about how to play him?
Discussions?
Mm-hmm. Discussions with your director.
There were no discussions with our director.
Who was Milos Forman, by the way.
Yeah. Discussions were not what he was about. I did about 900 hours of screen tests, and he did a good deal of work with me in that situation before he hired me. His theory being that actors are always much more open to what the director has to say before they've been given the job.
Yeah, right. I could see his point, I guess.
Well, you know, nice. Very nice. I didn't agree with that, uh-huh. but in point of fact, he did a lot of work with me at that point. And then we spent 2 days sitting in an extraordinary room in the house where he was living, looking out over the old part of Prague, and just went through the script, and he let me know, essentially by demonstration, what he was looking for. And we worked on the story up to the point where Mozart starts to decline. And then he said, I know you can do that, so we won't work on that.
Mm-hmm.
And we staged all of the scenes before we started filming all over Prague and the locations that they'd be taking place. And then that was it. There was no emotional discussion, intellectual discussion, psychological discussion. That wasn't the modus operandi.
What did Forman have you do in these elaborate screen tests?
Oh, you go into a TV studio. You know, it's usually 8 o'clock in the morning. The floor is white and curves up into a white wall. There's nothing there. There's a couple of video cameras. They put a costume and a wig on you and ask you to give them a reason to hire you. You play through scenes from the screenplay. One day I did 5 hours straight, and every 20 minutes different actors would come in and work opposite me as the other characters. And it was an excellent chance to see a lot of people in a high-pressure situation, and to see him work, and to see how he worked with the people he was interested in, and how he worked with the people who I guessed he wasn't interested in. And at the end of that day, when I was exhausted, he sort of looked at me and said, okay, you can go. I thought, oh, you know, great, great. But I'd also seen him be very curt with the people he seemed to be most intrigued with, so I took that all right. My last test I did opposite him, he played Salieri, and we did a couple of scenes. That was a lot of fun. He's actually a lot of fun to act with.
Well, tell you what, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
My guest is actor Tom Hulce, and he stars in the NBC TV movie Murder in Mississippi, which will be broadcast Monday night. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actor Tom Hulce is my guest. Let me ask you about your movie Dominic and Eugene. You played a 26-year-old mentally impaired man who was impaired from a childhood head injury. And, this character is working as a garbage collector, supporting mm-hmm. his twin brother through medical school. What did you do to try to understand what an accurate representation of such a character would be?
kind of just regulation research, hung out in an occupational training center here in Manhattan, spent time at the Board of Education in Brooklyn, where they employ a lot of mentally challenged folks. Spent some time talking with a guy in Pittsburgh where we were shooting who had a similar kind of injury. Worked on a garbage truck a bit. Hung out in the neighborhood where these guys lived. Spent a lot of time with Ray Liotta, who was my twin brother in the story. It's interesting to me that people find this part of acting like this is really hard work or unusual, and it's the acting that's the hard part. This part is just easy and fun, and you know, it's a kind of way to visit other people's worlds.
I wonder if it creates a lot of empathy on your part as an actor. You know, you've played all these different roles, so you know, you have empathy with civil rights workers. You have empathy with people who have, you know, mental disabilities. Do you know what I mean? Empathy with Mozart? I don't know. But you've imagined yourself as so many different characters.
Yeah, yeah. It's a kind of fascinating thing. In the guise of fiction, gotten to live some really extraordinary lives, or live moments from extraordinary lives. Sometimes I think I should stop living other people's lives and live an extraordinary life myself. But right now I feel like the best work I can do is through acting.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you about a movie of yours that I saw that I really liked, that I understand you probably don't like as much as I do, and that's the movie Slam Dance.
Uh-huh.
I liked your performance in it a lot. I thought it was a very stylish film.
Did you see it in a movie theater or on television?
In a movie theater.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Now tell me what you think of the movie. This is a movie, Tom Hulce plays an underground cartoonist who's framed for murder.
It's a big piece of style. That's what I my take on it is. It was a really frustrating experience working on it, because the concerns of the filmmakers were not about character, were not about story, were not about relationship. It was very much about where the camera was going to be at what moment and how it was moving. It got to the point where they got through half of a shot before they realized that Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and I weren't in it. We were standing behind the camera wondering how long it would take them to notice that the actors weren't in the picture. So it was just frustrating to be in a situation where the concerns of the filmmakers were not at all about the humans.
Mm-hmm. Actor Tom Hulce is my guest. Have you done any work besides acting?
I stuffed envelopes for a week for the Directory of New Musical Notation. They wanted to have international universal symbols for, you know, pieces of music where you hit a spoon on someone's head, that there would be a symbol for that so that everyone would know what that meant. sitting in a room with no windows that was a little bigger than a closet and doing a job that a machine could do. And I lasted for a week doing that.
Were you fired or did you quit?
No, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't sit there and do it. I didn't have the patience. I worked as a shopper for a number of months for the New York Shakespeare Festival. When I first came to New York, they gave me cash in an envelope every day, and I went out and bought things for them. Great job, really great job, a way to learn the city, run into all kinds of people in places that I never would have encountered otherwise. And it kept my hours flexible enough that I could go off and audition for things during the day as well as do my job.
Did you act as a child?
According to those that were around me, yes. Not professionally.
Mm-hmm. School plays, things like that?
No, I didn't get such good reception in school. I actually did plays, but I did them in Ann Arbor, about a half an hour away from where I lived, at the University of Michigan or under their auspices. So I had a kind of, it's interesting, I had a kind of success away from where I lived that I didn't have where I lived. Maybe that accounts for my leaving as early as I did.
Leaving where?
Home.
How old were you when you left home?
15.
Was this running away from home or what?
Well, I was running towards acting.
Without your parents' permission?
Not necessarily their
blessing,
unified and wholehearted support.
Yeah.
But I didn't pack up and say, you know, I'm off to join the carnival.
You once said that when you were younger, you thought you wouldn't make it past your 20s. What made you think that?
Oh, some kind of romantic notion, I think. All of my goals that I had and sort of daydreams about what might happen were all centered around the time to my mid-20s. So it was pretty confusing to find myself having pretty much achieved any of the goals or lived out the fantasies that I'd had and still be alive, and it's kind of still being the beginning of my working and my life in some way. So my mid and later 20s included a lot of time sorting out what I wanted, mm-hmm. and if I wanted to continue acting. Part of me thinks that acting is a phase, that there's something else that I'll be doing, and I don't know what it is, but I always have my my antenna up to be available to whatever that might be. There's, I'll tell you, I just got a call this morning from Milos Forman, and they're putting together an event for Havel, who is now the, as I'm sure you know, the president of Czechoslovakia, and so Milos called up, and in an attempt to support him, and there will be elections in the spring, he explained that because of Amadeus, I'm one of the most popular actors in Czechoslovakia, American actors, and asked if I'd be willing to be a part of this tribute to him, and that it would potentially help shape what was happening over there. And you know, there's a certain amount of flattery involved in that comment on his part to get me to show up, but also the fact that my work as an actor can also be put to that kind of use is thrilling,
mm-hmm.
really thrilling.
Well, Tom Hulse, I thank you a lot for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Tom Hulse plays civil rights worker Michael Schwerner in the made-for-TV movie Murder in Mississippi, which will be broadcast on NBC this Monday night. Hulse is also now starring on Broadway in the play A Few Good Men. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In October 1988, Tom Rose was one of more than 150 journalists who converged on Barrow, Alaska, to follow the story of three whales trapped in the Arctic ice. In 1989, Rose returned to Barrow to investigate the story behind the story. Coming up, we discuss his new book, Freeing the Whales, How the Media Created the World's Greatest Non-Event. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews albums by Christine Lavin and They Might Be Giants. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us why he's all shook up about the new TV series, Elvis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. South African President F.W. de Klerk announced a wide-ranging package of liberalization measures today, including the unbanning of the outlawed African National Congress. NPR's John Madison reports from Cape Town.
De Klerk said the ANC and several dozen other opposition groups will be legalized immediately. He relaxed the censorship regulations under the 3.5-year-old state of emergency, and he promised to release black political leader Nelson Mandela from jail soon. De Klerk said these measures should make it possible for black leaders to join the government in negotiations for a new constitution. Several opposition leaders welcomed the announcements, but said that the emergency needs to be repealed entirely before they would feel free to engage in political activity and take part in talks. Spontaneous demonstrations broke out in the streets of several towns after the announcement, and in Johannesburg, police used tear gas to disperse opposition groups. I'm John Madison in Cape Town.
The Bush administration has praised President de Klerk's moves as positive, but it does not seem likely that U.S. sanctions against South Africa will be eased yet. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
President Bush said this morning, when people move in the right direction, it is certainly time to review all policy. But he also indicated that South Africa's white minority government needs to go further before U.S. sanctions are eased. We want to see the policy initiatives go forward. The release of Mandela, the president said, as he traveled to North Carolina aboard Air Force One. In fact, the administration will not be able to make a unilateral decision about U.S. sanctions. Most of them were imposed by Congress over President Reagan's veto, and Congress will have to concur before the sanctions are eased. The administration announced yesterday that it will invite Nelson Mandela to the White House if he is freed, and will also invite President de Klerk at a different time. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Peruvian President Alan Garcia will attend a drug summit in Colombia on February 15th because President Bush has promised to reduce the number of U.S. troops in Panama to their pre-invasion levels. Almost immediately after the invasion, Garcia said he would boycott the summit. The meeting is to include the presidents of Colombia and Bolivia, as well as Garcia and President Bush. Two commuter trains collided during evening rush hour in Frankfurt, West Germany today. At least 17 people were killed and more than 70 others were injured. A railway official said one of the train engineers apparently missed a stop signal. About 2,000 passengers were on the trains at the time. The spokesman said the trains were traveling at a relatively slow speed at the time of the crash. The renegade black priest from Washington who defied church authorities and offered his own liturgy for black Catholics may be excommunicated. The Reverend George Stallings plans to start a church that would admit women as priests and break away from Rome. Stallings disclosed his plans in Chicago at DePaul University and during an interview on the Donahue Talk Show. The Washington priest says the Roman Catholic Church still fails to meet the needs of black Catholics, and as a result, he's forming the African American Church congregation. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's hard to find humor in music these days, outside of novelty tunes and some funny rap music, but he has a review of two new albums by New York-based acts whose reputations are based on their wit. Ken says one succeeds, the other doesn't.
Oppressed by the seriousness and pretentiousness of a lot of new albums I was listening to, I started casting about for a few good, funny songs. At first, the best I could come up with was Christine Lavin and her new album called Attainable Love. Lavin has a strong cult following for her variations on the Can't Find a Good Man theme, as epitomized by her song Sensitive New Age Guys.
Who like to talk about their feelings?
Sensitive New Age Guys.
Who's into crystals, into healing?
Sensitive New Age Guys.
Who like to dress like Richard Simmons?
Sensitive New Age Guys.
Who are hard to tell from women?
Sensitive New Age Guys.
That's the sort of song you could admire in principle, noting its impeccable wordplay and clever execution, while disliking in practice. It's a bit too clever, too clean-cut, too contemptuous of the sort of men you begin to suspect Christine Lavin would like if she met anyway. I don't want to give you the wrong impression. This album isn't full of humorous material. It's got a lot of well-crafted, serious folk music that I also don't ever want to hear a second time. But her basic attitude climaxes with the album's final composition, something called Shopping Cart of Love, a Play.
I ran to the supermarket in a blinding rage, craving foods I have not touched since I was 12 years of age. 'Cause not only did my man run out today, my boss let me go. I have been depressed before, but never quite this low. Yes, I guess I've been depressed, but ever this low? No. And I ran up and down the aisles of the supermarket, crying and shaking and pulling things off the shelves based solely on their carbohydrate, calorie, and cholesterol count. I didn't go overboard, just enough to get me through the night.
That sort of thing goes on for more than 8 minutes. No kidding. Christine Lavin is the Wendy Wasserstein of folk music. Intelligent, funny, but manipulative all at the same time. How relieved I was, therefore, when my search for humorous pop music led me to Flood, the major label debut of the duo that calls itself They Might Be Giants.
They might be giants.
Boy.
They might be giants.
They might be brave. They might be wash. They might be Dr. Spock's backup.
So that everyone needs to hang on tighter
just to keep from being thrown to the wolves.
Tabloid footprints in your hair. Tabloid footprints everywhere. We can't be silent because they might be giants. And what are we going to do unless they are? They might be giants.
They Might Be Giants is singer-guitarist John Flansburg and singer-accordionist John Linnell. They met in high school in Massachusetts, relocated in adulthood to Brooklyn, and put out a couple of independent releases that were critically acclaimed but not really bought by regular people. One of the things I really like about these guys is that, unlike Christine Lavin, who seems all too smugly resigned to be a cult act, They Might Be Giants works hard to get their music heard by a large, diverse audience. To this end, a few years ago, they started something called Dial-A-Song. Every day, they put a different one of their songs on tape, and you can dial 718-387-6962 and listen to a fresh example of their witty material. This stunt got them a lot of publicity, but they also had the music to back it up.
Particle man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle man, is he a dot or is he a speck? When he's underwater, does he get wet? Or does the water get him instead? Nobody knows. Particle man. Triangle man, triangle man hates particle man. They have a fight, triangle wins, triangle man.
That song is typical of They Might Be Giants' approach. It's a light, funny song on the surface, but it's also so surreal and elusive that it gets you thinking even as you smile. This sort of thing also sets you up for some of the duo's more straightforward music, such as Your Racist Friend.
This is Wayne.
They Might Be Giants can serve as the best current model for what humorous pop music should be. They're not oppressively hip or ironic, yet their music is subtle and complex enough to stand up to repeated listenings. Plus, they're pretty darn funny.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Here's another song from the album Flood by They Might Be Giants. This is Whistling in the Dark.
A woman came up to me and said, I'd like to poison your mind with wrong ideas that appeal to you, though I am not unkind. She looked at me, I looked at something written across her scalp, and these are the words that it faintly said as I tried to call for help. There's only one thing that I know how to do well, and I've often been told that you only can do what you know how to do well, and that's be you. Be what you're like. Be like yourself. And so I'm having a wonderful time, but I'd rather be whistling in the dark. 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 There's only one thing that I like, and that is whistling in the dark.
This is Fresh Air. You probably remember the story. It was almost a national obsession. In October 1988, three California gray whales were trapped in the Arctic ice. The rescue of the whales cost over $5.5 million, involved both the President of the United States and the General Secretary of the Soviet Union, and became one of the biggest news stories of the time. Tom Rose was one of the more than 150 journalists from four continents who came to Barrow, Alaska to cover the story. For Rose, the whales were a media-created non-event. His new book, Freeing the Whales, investigates the story behind the story, why these whales made headlines. Rose covered the story for a Japanese television network. His assignment was to cover the media itself and to explain the whale obsession to Japan, where whaling has been an historically important industry and whale meat a delicacy. I asked Tom Rose if reporting for Japan gave him a cynical bias from the start.
When I first learned of this whole adventure, I learned of it the same way every other American had. I learned of it by watching it on my television, and for the first two or three days, I was as enamored, as enthused, as excited to see these whales freed as anyone was. When I got the call from Tokyo and I heard my producer explaining our mission, so to speak, I said, oh my God, you know, I'm going up there to report for a bunch of whalers. Here these three whales are waging a magnificent heroic struggle to free themselves from the brutal Arctic elements, and I'm going up there to work for a bunch of whalers. It was only really after I got there and after I began to observe the goings-on of my colleagues and myself that the cynicism really began to emerge. And I wasn't the only one. We all, I think, felt exactly the same, that this was while at the same time one of the more interesting, remarkable, memorable experiences of our lives, it was also the most ludicrous news event that any of us had ever covered or most likely will ever cover.
Why do you think they became the lead story?
Because, first of all, people love whales. Here was an opportunity unparalleled in the history of television to see whales outside of a zoo in their natural habitat in really a magnificent fashion. All you had to do was open up your tripod, set it on the edge of the ice, focus and shoot. It was television journalism par excellence. There was no need for elaborate commentary. George Will wasn't required. It was simply television pictures. It was an image story, one bereft really of any news, but that doesn't seem to make much difference in this day and age, I'm afraid.
Who are some of the parties that you think used this story opportunistically?
I think the media did. I think the Eskimos did. I think the oil companies did. I think the environmentalists did, and certainly the Soviets did.
Okay, how do you think the oil companies did?
Well, the oil companies were at the time in the midst of a heated, nearly decade-long battle to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge oil fields, which was adjacent to Prudhoe Bay. Environmentalists in Alaska had precluded them from achieving the Senate approval that they needed, and in October of '88, they were darn close to tipping the votes of the three or four senators needed to pass it. This was an effort to push those senators over the balance, to show that oil companies and oil executives were as concerned with the plight of endangered whales or so thought endangered whales as anyone else was. If they could prove that, if they could save these whales, if it would cost $1 million or a reasonable derivation thereof, that's nothing. But 6 months later, when the Exxon Valdez struck Bly Island in Prince William Sound, ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge issue, was dead.
How do you think the environmental groups use this opportunistically?
They used it opportunistically to tremendous effect in Europe, more so than in America. Another irony was that one of the more remarkable offshoots of this story went totally uncovered in the American press. The government of Iceland at the time was one of four remaining whaling countries left in the world in defiance of an International Whaling Commission ban. Iceland had succeeded in thwarting a Greenpeace Greenpeace boycott, rather, in Europe for about 6 months. Greenpeace had launched this boycott in hopes of getting Iceland to change its whaling policies. For 6 months, it bore no fruit at all. Suddenly, these whales became news. West German fish retailers began to feel the heat of a suddenly reinvigorated boycott. Within a few days, the two largest grocery store chains in West Germany announced they would no longer do business with Iceland until Iceland ceased its whaling practices. And the government of Iceland was pitched into turmoil and nearly collapsed. 6 months later, or rather 9 months later, in August of 89, Iceland announced that it too was getting out of the whaling business forever.
It was a Soviet icebreaker that actually cut through the ice to finally free the whales. Do you think the Soviets acted opportunistically here?
Oh, they were the most brazen opportunists of all, without question. The two Soviet icebreakers that were working on the Polar Star Research Station, about 300 miles north of Barrow at the time, were given orders, strange cryptic orders from Moscow, to head south to Barrow, Alaska. They had been for 90 or 120 days, I can't remember which, but for many, many months, embedded in Arctic ice working on this research station, and the captains of these ships get this strange message to go to Barrow. They didn't know what was going on, so they go to Barrow, they follow their orders, they find these three whales, they cut about an 8-mile swath through the ice so the whales can swim free. They journey on their way back to Providenia, their home port of Providenia. The Russians emerge as the great environmentalists, the great heroes of this story, when in fact they were then and remain now the largest single killers of gray whales in the world, the very species of whales that were trapped. As a matter of fact, as these whales swam off, Soviet whaling vessels, subsistence whaling vessels that are armed with the fanciest equipment that wouldn't normally qualify under the definition of subsistence whaling, were waiting right offshore. That they might have possibly killed these whales themselves.
Well, you were there in Barrow in October of 1988 covering this story. You say at one point there was one reporter for every 17 residents of Barrow.
That would be like a million reporters crawling the streets of New York. Can you imagine that?
I'm sure that Barrow wasn't equipped with hotels and facilities and maybe even with food, with all the reporters that were there. Were there a lot of... how did reporters get rooms?
Well, there were a few rooms. There were two small hotels. I guess hotel is a euphemistic term for guest lodging in Barrow. Many of us, myself included, stayed at Eskimo homes on floors and on couches in driftwood shacks or in homes of local families. Of course, we had to pay most dearly for the privilege to the tune of, $100-$150 per head per night. None of us had any idea what we were getting into. Very few of us came up there with enough money. And it's a cash-only place, no American Express or MasterCharge allowed in Barrow. So we had to come with cash or, better yet, liquor.
There is an alcoholism problem in Alaska. How did you feel about using alcohol as a bribe almost to get rooms?
When I first got the call to go to Barrow, I picked up the phone and dialed Barrow. I dialed the 907 area code and then just asked for any number in Barrow because I had no idea where I was going or what I was doing. I finally, after a few calls, got a hold of this one fellow who was telling me what I said, well, what do I need to bring? What do I need to know? I'm leaving in 2 hours. He said, just remember this. Bring Long John's and liquor, not necessarily in that order. Those are the two most important things. Well, it never really dawned on me why it was so important to have liquor. So when I got to Anchorage and met up with my crew that had come respectively from Tokyo and Toronto, We didn't really worry about clothing. We went to the nearest wholesale liquor warehouse and bought several hundred dollars worth of liquor. And it wasn't until the flight from Anchorage to Barrow that I was sitting next to a member of the Barrow School Board, who was at a Native Alaskan conference, who was telling me, an Eskimo woman, obviously, who was telling me about the ravages of alcohol. And there I am, and I've got literally hundreds of dollars worth of alcohol sitting in the overhead compartment above her head. I was shriveling in my seat to the point of wishing I could simply evaporate. I was so mortified in guilt.
So what did you do with the hundreds of dollars of liquor that you bought to take with you to Alaska?
Well, I'm proud to say, I didn't, none of it was dispersed for that purpose, but perhaps not too proudly, I could say that it was all disposed of by ourselves. In a matter of 3 weeks, the press corps ourselves, we began to realize why Eskimos have such problems, because the sole objective in the Arctic, particularly at that time of year, the sole purpose for living is to stay warm, and one will do really just about anything to stay warm, and that oftentimes includes drinking.
Mm-hmm. You are still a practicing journalist.
Right.
What's the moral of this story for you when you go out to cover stories now, or when you edit other people's?
It was a remarkable transformation for me. I learned something that I would have never even fathomed I would have learned. Ever since Charles Darwin, really since the latter part of the last century, we in the West have been in a headlong rush to desanctify man. And the result is that today, anti-vivisectionists who march in streets in cities across the country saying that the value of the life of a rat is no less important than the value of the life of a human being is true. That is precisely what has happened, and the end result is we spend $6 million to save three whales trapped by nature, not by man. Animal life has now become as important as human life. I think that's a great tragedy, and I don't mean for an instant to say that these whales didn't deserve human compassion. It was simply not possible to see these whales and feel tremendous empathy for them and to want them freed. But what we seem to have lost our ability to do is to separate, distinguish, and to determine any sense of proportionate response for human compassion. If only humans could elicit the kind of compassion and love and tender care that we gave these whales, I think this world would be a much better place in which to live.
Tom Rose is the author of Freeing the Whales. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Linda, what are your latest stories from South Africa?
Ever since the president, F.W. de Klerk, announced that he was unbanning the African National Congress, making a previously illegal political organization legal again, we've been in touch with a variety of people in South Africa, black leaders, white leaders, people who are officials in the government and officials in the African National Congress. And there's a lot of excitement and a lot of doubt and concern coming out of South Africa. John Madison, of course, will give us the big political story, and then we'll talk to a lot of people.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Since his death, Elvis has been the subject of documentaries and made-for-TV movies. Now he's got his own series. TV critic David Bianculli has this review of Elvis.
I never thought I'd say this, but I saw Elvis last night. Not Elvis the ghost or Elvis the still-alive somehow survivor, but Elvis the TV series, which I previewed on tape. And as unlikely as it sounds, this Elvis is no hound dog. Actually, it's not that unlikely at all. A weekly series about Elvis Presley almost had to happen sooner or later, because most of the TV docudramas about him have gotten good reviews and even better ratings. Except for that 1981 clunker, Elvis and the Beauty Queen, which starred Don Johnson as Elvis. The rest of the Elvis TV history, if you can stand a little trivia, includes the excellent 1979 telemovie called Elvis, which starred Kurt Russell and was directed by John Carpenter. And there was the 1988 miniseries Elvis and Me, which starred Dale Midkiff of NBC's short-lived Dream Street and was co-produced by Priscilla Presley, whose story it told. Now, after all these TV Elvises, or Elvi, comes the ABC series Elvis, which premieres Tuesday. It's also co-produced by Priscilla Presley, but this isn't her story this time. It's a portrait of the Elvis as a young man, years before Priscilla entered the picture. The guy who provides Elvis's singing voice in the early scenes is Nashville's Ronnie McDowell. Later, the series will use actual Presley recordings whenever possible. After a brief prologue showing Elvis as a child, the series begins with the singer's first visit to Sun Records to record a song for his mother as a birthday present. Michael St. Gerard, who played Ricky Lake's boyfriend in Hairspray, is Elvis, and Jordan Williams plays record producer Sam Phillips.
Well, who do you sound like?
I don't sound like nobody, really.
Nobody really? Don't think I ever heard of him. Well, Mr. Presley, don't get too close to the mic. Remember the lyrics, and I got a feeling you're gonna do just fine.
Evening shadows make me blue. When each weary day is through.
The writers for the Elvis series waste no time in propelling Elvis on his road to stardom. Before the first episode is over, Phillips has paired Elvis with backup musicians, Scotty Moore, played by Jesse Dabson, and Bill Black, played by Blake Gibbons. In the second episode, Elvis gets yelled at by Phillips for not singing with any emotion, and responds by clowning around in the studio and singing an old song double time.
One, two, one, two, three, four.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right with you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right.
Phillips records it, gets it to a Memphis DJ, and presto, the record's an instant local hit. That's all in the second episode, which is something considering that this Elvis series is a half-hour drama instead of the standard hour. By starting in 1954, when Elvis began his recording career, this Elvis series has a lot of momentum. What it lacks is a sense of where his talent came from in the first place. Even though this young Elvis is raw, he's already fully formed as a distinctly different singer. Even so, Elvis the TV series, like Elvis the Performer, has style to burn. The TV series is shot like a feature film, and uses visual imagery as carefully and cleverly as it uses authentic Elvis Presley recordings. It's as satisfying as the Buddy Holly story in La Bamba, and another good move by ABC, which is where more and more TV risks are being taken these days.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. We welcome Dorothy Farabee to the Fresh Air staff, our station services assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
What's wrong with me? I met you like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Michael Doris is a Native American activist and scholar. On the next Fresh Air, we discuss fetal alcohol syndrome, a mental and physical disability of children born to alcoholic mothers. Doris thinks the syndrome is one of the greatest threats facing Native Americans. His adopted son is one of the many victims. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.